Hey guys, welcome to another episode of True Crimes and Weird Times. I'm Kim.
And I'm Ashley.
And today, I'll be telling you the story of Angelique Coton, aka the Electric Girl. At 14 years old, Angelique began making things fly across the room by simply touching them. After being examined by many physicians, the true cause for her strange powers has never been determined.
And I'll be telling you the strange story of Mary Ashford and Barbara Forrest, two women who died in the same town, the same age, the same way, under some of the same circumstances, on the same holiday, and even found on the same day, 157 years apart.
Angelique Coton, and sorry everyone if I'm saying that terribly, my French is not good, was born in, Ashley's laughing at me.
Sorry. I can speak it either. So, yeah. I mean, we're good.
Angelique was born in 1832 in the village of Beauvigny in the district of Perrier, France. Again, sorry guys.
This is per Google. Okay.
Now, Angelique had a fairly normal life full of chores, some rudimentary education, and of course, work. By the age of 14, Angelique was living with her widowed aunt in a small cottage near the Chateau of Montimer to work in the family business weaving ladies' silk gloves.
Ooh, fancy.
Yeah.
I like that.
In January of 1846, the area where Angelique lived had been pelted with constant thunderstorms for 8 days, leading up to Angelique's first strange incident. The atmosphere had been charged with electricity, and many speculate that the storms had something to do with the strange powers that Angelique developed.
Ooh.
On January 15th, around 8 p.m., Angelique and three other young girls were in her aunt's cottage weaving gloves on this large oak frame. Now, it was already dark, and the girls were working by candlelight at this point. All of a sudden, the large frame began to shake and tremble, and it shook so violently that it knocked their candlestick off the table, plunging them into darkness. So, of course, the girls all immediately blame each other for the accident. Like, why did you knock it over? No, you knocked it over. But none of them would admit that they had done anything. They were just blaming each other. So eventually they just relit the candle and they're like, oh, whatever, let's just get back to work. Yeah. But then a second time, the frame began to shake violently. And this time the frame was even knocked completely over.
No, thank you.
Now, this obviously freaked the girls out. And they went running outside screaming and they immediately were suspecting witchcraft. You know, it's the 1800s.
Sorry, yeah.
You know, our frame fell over twice. The witches are at it.
It's a witch.
Now, some neighbors heard the commotion outside. They came out to see what was going on, and they find, you know, the girls out there panicking. Now, the girls told them what happened, and they basically said to the girls, you know, come on, guys, quit being silly. Like, nothing's going on. That's impossible. Go back to work.
Go back to work.
So the girls cautiously went back inside, and two of them touched the now upright frame, and nothing happened. So they started working again. But as soon as Angelique touched her own part of the frame, it once again began to shake violently before being thrown backwards across the room.
Yikes.
Angelique went after the frame to grab it and like set it back up. Mm-hmm. But when she reached out to get it, it shot away from her hand the moment she made contact.
What a way to get out of work.
I know. She's really going to extremes here. Now, since this was the 1800s, Angelique's aunt also immediately suspected witchcraft, or maybe even demon possession. Hmm. You know, as is the explanation for many things back then. So she took her niece to the priest of La Perrier and demanded an exorcism be done on her.
Oh, no.
Like, that's her first step.
Yeah, 0 to 60 real quick.
Now, thank God for this priest, because at first, he didn't believe her at all. Like, he even laughed at the absurdity of this story. Like, oh, your frame fell over and you think it's a demon? Okay.
Yeah.
But Angelique was actually prepared to demonstrate these strange powers for him. Okay. So she had brought the glove that she had been weaving, because at this point they don't know what's causing
right,
it.
Right.
So she brought the glove, and she used the glove to touch one of his kitchen chairs, which immediately began to shake and eventually tipped over away from her.
Yikes. Okay.
Next, the priest sat down in the chair and had her repeat the whole thing. This time, both the chair and the priest in it were thrown backwards and toppled over to the ground.
That's a brave priest, by the way, to just sit down and
yeah,
do I that mean, without knowing what's going on.
I guess it's like, let's see if she... Okay, see if you can do that with me on the chair. Yeah. And she definitely did. Now, if you're anything like me, at this point, you're probably screaming, don't show the priest your magic powers while people still believe in witchcraft.
Yep.
But surprisingly, this priest decided that this was not, in fact, dark magic and instead referred Angelique to a physician to be treated.
That is not what I was expecting.
Not at all. That's why, thank God for this priest, because they could have just burned her at the stake immediately. Yep. So after the visit to this priest, Angelique's powers seemed to vanish for about 3 days. During this time, the family got in touch with a doctor named Monsieur de Fermont. Once the strange thing started up again, the doctor was invited to the cottage to witness this phenomenon for himself. Fermont watched as the girl touched the wooden frame, which immediately flew away from her across the room. Amazed at what he just saw, he sat the frame back up and asked her to touch it again. But this time, he was going to hold on to it. Even exerting all of his strength, he was unable to keep this frame still. He did notice that the frame had kind of a rotary movement to it, so it would kind of rock from left to right.
Okay.
And that no other part of Angelique's body made contact with the frame when these movements happened. So she was just touching it with her fingers. Yeah. She wasn't grabbing it. She wasn't kicking it with her foot, like just touching it.
Well, also find it weird that it's made of wood, like.
Right.
I don't know anything about electricity, let's be honest. But, like, that seems weird. Like,
I don't think wood is a conductor, but that's, you know, it's been a long time since I took any kind of science about it.
I wouldn't assume it is. It's, so that's strange that it's the wooden chair, the wooden frame. Like, I don't know.
It does seem to primarily affect wooden objects.
Huh. That's really weird. Okay.
He had also observed that there was some sort of push and pull phenomenon where after the frame was repulsed, it seemed to draw her hand towards it for a moment as it flew away from her.
Huh.
So think like static electricity,
yeah.
How it would pull something as it moves away. Right. That's what it would kind of do to her hand. He also noted that when she made contact with a piece of furniture that was too heavy to move, Angelique herself would be flung backwards away from it.
Oh, wow.
So if the furniture didn't go flying, Angelique would go flying in the opposite direction.
I mean, I guess that's physics. I still don't know anything about science, guys.
The doctor also noticed that these strange occurrences seemed to be draining the young girl and immediately set to work looking for answers to help her. So she would do one of these experiments, and then she would just be, like, exhausted and kind of out of it. Like, she was just drained, like, just no energy.
Okay.
Now, after this, Angelique's powers seemed to become stronger. Wood and earth materials seemed to react the strongest, which made this all even stranger, as this is believed to be related to electricity, like we were just saying.
Yeah.
Like, why is wood and earth materials being affected more?
That is really weird.
I don't really know at this point how they decided that this is because of electricity. Electricity was a fairly new thing for them. Like, electric lights existed, but they weren't around in everybody's houses yet. Like, they were working by candlelight.
Yeah.
Like, they knew about it, but they
it wasn't
something everybody had experience with yet.
Right.
Chairs would slide across the room or violently shake when she tried to sit down in them. Her bed would even shake at night, preventing her from getting any real restful sleep.
Oh, jeez.
And she didn't even have to always touch the objects. Some objects would shake or fly across the room after she brushed up against it with her dress, or even just being a little too close to them. Papers and pens on desks would suddenly fly off as if they'd been hit by a gust of wind when Angelique walked past them.
That would get real annoying very quickly.
Oh, yeah. Her family also claimed that she made their table levitate off the ground and that things had actually become kind of dangerous for them.
Yeah.
Because along with chairs and furniture, there were now all sorts of things randomly flying through the house. Things like shovels, tongs, heavy books, scissors that had been attached to her waistband just flew off and flung across the room. Even burning wood from the fireplace.
I'm like, all right, sis, sit down.
She can't. The chairs move.
On the ground? I don't know. Stop moving.
Like, imagine just trying to live your life in your house and then just things that could kill you come flying around the room. In another instance, Angelique attempted to sit in a chair that was being held down by three strong men. But despite their best efforts, it was ripped from their hands and flew several yards away.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. On the 24th of January, Fairmont decided to try another experiment with Angelique. He got a wooden block weighing around 150 pounds. He then had Angelique sit down next to the block so that only her dress was touching it. The block instantly raised up 3 to 4 inches off the ground and would continue to rise and fall like that about 40 times in just 1 minute.
What is happening? Think
of it kind of bouncing,
yeah,
like up and down. And this is just with her dress touching it. I mean, she's not even physically touching the block of wood. He then gave her a little break and he went and sat on top of the wooden block and he repeated the experiment. Again, the block levitated up and down exactly the same way. So he finally had three more men come in and sit on top of the block. At this point, it's got to be at least 400 pounds. And again, the block continued to rise and fall, although not quite so high this time because of the extra weight. But it was still up and down.
Yeah, but it's still moving.
Dr. Fairmont said, "It is certain that I and one of the most athletic porters of the Halley could not have lifted that block with the three persons seated on it." In other words, like, we couldn't have picked this up if we'd wanted to.
Right. It's not moving.
Yeah. Like, it's heavy. We don't know why it's moving.
Yeah.
By this time, news of Angelique's powers had spread, and other people and physicians were coming to see this oddity for themselves.
Of course. Of course they are.
What else is there to do? Weave more silk gloves, I guess?
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
On January 28th, another physician named Dr. Verger came to see Angelique. While he was there, he witnessed Angelique attempting to shell a large basket of peas. But as she leaned forward to begin, her dress brushed up against the basket and it sent these peas flying all over the room.
Nope. Nope.
Talk about infuriating.
I'm not doing it.
This was repeated two more times with the same results. A Dr. Lemonnier testified to seeing the same phenomenon, as well as noticing that her left hand seemed to have a greater effect than her right hand. Hmm. He also reported that himself and another gentleman tried with all of their strength to hold a chair that Angelique sat in, but despite their best efforts, it was violently forced from them, and one of its legs was even broken in the process.
What is going on?
Yeah, everyone wants to know.
Yeah.
On January 30th, Dr. Fairmont decided to try an isolation experiment. So he put a sheet of glass on the ground, which I guess he knew at least a little bit of about electricity at that point.
Yeah.
So he puts the sheet of glass on the ground, and then he set a wooden chair on top of it. He then had Angelique stand on the glass and sit down. To everyone's amazement, the chair remained still and nothing happened.
Ooh. Okay.
So it seems once they separated her feet from the ground with the glass, she was able to sit in the chair.
So it does sound like electricity then.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And I don't know if this is when they decided that's what it was or if they had decided it earlier. You know, since this account is from the 1800s, it's hard to get it completely accurate. At this point, several doctors were involved, but rather than try and pronounce each name, I'm just going to proceed by telling you the tests and the results of them, because it's not really super important who did what exactly here. So just know that there were many witnesses to Angelique's powers, like lots of different doctors around trying these tests on her.
Okay, I'll take it.
The experiment was repeated a week later with the same results, with the glass and the chair.
Mm-hmm.
And during the second experiment, they also discovered that they actually didn't need to isolate the chair, only Angelique.
Mm.
They also tried an experiment where one of the doctors basically licked his arm hair to make it lay down flat on his arm.
Okay.
He then held his arm up near Angelique's left arm, and every single time, the hairs would stand up straight, like static electricity. Yeah. And so this was just further proof to them that, you know, this is electricity.
Yeah.
This is something to do with electricity. We don't know how or why, but we know that it is.
Yeah, we have some kind of an answer.
Now, these doctors also noticed that the power seemed to kind of drain Angelique of energy, and she would just be exhausted after all these tests. Her powers also seemed to be stronger when she was at ease and relaxed, and between the hours of 7 and 9 p.m.
Huh.
They speculated that the time frame had something to do with her having recently eaten her largest meal of the day, thus giving her more energy.
Okay.
So, basically, in these times, you'd have, like, your snack at breakfast, and then your snack at lunch, and you'd have a big meal in the evening. So they just said, well, she eats the most at night. That's why it's strongest.
I could see that.
It's also important to note that these experiments were being conducted in full view of an audience. People were flocking to see the amazing electric girl. And by the beginning of February, over 2,000 people had come to witness the phenomenon, including doctors, lawyers, magistrates, and of course, all the locals.
Well, yeah, obviously. So there was no denying that something was going on.
This is not just someone's account, like, we saw it. You should be like, thousands of people saw this happening.
Yeah.
Also, by this point in time, if Angelique wanted to sit down, she had no choice but to sit on the floor.
Oh.
Because she couldn't sit on any chair without it flying away from her.
Yeah.
It was also at this point, against the advice of all the doctors who had been treating Angelique so far, her father decided it was time to take her to Paris to make some money off of her.
Oh.
So up until this point, like, all these people have been coming to see it happen, but it's just, they're coming to watch it. Nobody's making any money. Nobody's charging. They're just coming to see it happen. But, you know, she'd been living with her widowed aunt for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And now her dad's like, wait a minute. Uh-huh. Let's go. Let's go make a little money here.
Jeez.
The doctors did warn her father that the electric charges were actually putting his daughter in danger and that they should try to stop these things so that she could heal and rest.
Yeah.
But the family didn't listen. And they forced Angelique to perform daily.
Oh.
By the end of the exhibition, not only was Angelique exhausted, but her powers had begun to fade.
Oh.
While in Paris, Angelique was examined by a committee that had been put together at the Museum of Natural History. It was put together by Drs. Arago and Tanchu, who had heard of her powers through a colleague who had witnessed them and recruited his friend Dr. Arago to do an initial examination. The two doctors examined Angelique on their own before the committee did, and they witnessed a few examples of her powers, including a cold burst of wind blowing through the room from her, a heavy wooden table moving away from her, and even the couch Dr. Tanchu was sitting on flew across the room, slamming into the wall as Angelique attempted to sit down on it.
Yikes.
Can you imagine sitting on a couch and some 14-year-old girl comes to sit down and it just blasts you across the room into the wall? The men also noticed that Angelique's left side tended to be warmer than her right side. And when objects flew away from her, her clothing would be pulled towards it until it was too far from reach. Again, like that static pull.
Yeah, okay.
They also determined that when she touched a magnet on its north pole, Angelique would get a shock, but nothing happened when she touched the south pole of the magnet.
Mm.
It was also determined that Angelique couldn't stand being touched from behind, especially on her neck, as it would produce a painful shock to her.
Hmm.
They also would bring a compass. After they found the magnet thing, they brought a compass, and the compass needle would point towards Angelique instead of north. So it didn't take long for them to testify to proof of her powers and publish such in the journal Des Débats in February of 1846. So they came and saw it, and they're like, well, let's write a book.
Yeah.
And they did, and they just put it out there for everyone. However, by March 9th, when the rest of the committee had completed their exams and experiments, they weren't able to recreate any of the previous experiments other than a chair flying across the room.
So she was getting weaker.
Yeah.
Okay.
But even that, they suspected was from concealed maneuvers of her hands and feet. So, like, they're not believing her.
Oh. Well, think about it, too. If her dad is trying to make money off of her and she's actually losing powers, it's probably a, you better figure out how to make this work.
Right.
Yeah. They don't want to lose that money.
She could no longer distinguish between the two poles of a magnet. No tables scooted across the floor when she approached. No one's hair stood on end when she was near them with her left arm. Like, nothing happened. They did, however, conduct an experiment that left Angelique with nightmares for months to come.
Oh, no.
Like, this whole... these people. So they decided to bring Angelique in contact with a Voltic battery. They then took a dead and dissected frog and placed it on her arm. Now, this frog was totally skinned so that the lumbar nerves and muscles were exposed.
Nope.
They then had, so they put this, like, dissected frog with no skin on her arm and made her look at this dead frog here.
Laying on her arm.
On her arm.
Was the idea to make it move or something?
Yes. Okay. So they then had Angelique touch the battery with her hand, and the current from the battery then stimulated the nerves and caused the frog to jump off her arm.
I'm sorry. All I picture is Looney Tunes. Hello, my baby. Hello.
And then it sang a little song.
And then it sang a song.
But Angelique was actually so traumatized by this that she didn't speak for the rest of the day. And she had nightmares of dead frogs coming to life for the next few weeks.
Yeah, the poor girl.
And, I mean, honestly, this experiment did nothing because anybody could do this. Anybody could put current through muscles and nerves and make the frog move. This had nothing to do with Angelique. Ugh. Angelique's powers began diminishing even further after this experiment, and ultimately the committee declared there to be nothing special about Angelique, with the inclination being that she was a fraud.
So not only did this poor girl have to deal with all of this anyway, then she got monetized by her own father. And then when they would finally come to study her, her powers start to diminish, and then she gets, even if she's free, yay, you know, I don't have to deal with it anymore. Now she's considered a fraud.
Yes.
That's insane.
Yep. And she's only 14 years old.
That poor kid.
However, remember all those thousands of people and doctors and witnesses that saw her powers in the first few weeks? Mm-hmm. Many of those people not only rejected the committee's findings, they publicly refuted them.
Oh, wow.
In March of 1846, as the committee was conducting its experiments and news of their disbelief was spreading, a man named Dr. Kohu received inquiries about Angelique's powers. You see, this guy had witnessed some of her earlier powers when they were still really strong, along with other thousands of people back in her hometown. Dr. Kohu responded thusly, "It matters not what name we may give to this. The important point is to verify the reality of a repulsive agency and of one that is distinctly marked. The effects it is impossible to deny. We may assign to this agency what seat we please, in the cerebellum, in the pelvis, or elsewhere. In fact, it's material, visible, incontestable. Here in the province, sir, we are not very learned, but we are often mistrustful. In the present ease, we have examined, re-examined, taken every possible precaution against deception, and the more we have seen, the deeper has been our conviction of the reality of the phenomenon. Let the Academy decide as it will. We have seen, it has not seen. We are, therefore, in a condition to decide better than it can. I do not say what cause was operating, but what effects presented themselves under circumstances that remove even the shadow of a doubt."
Wow. Good for him.
I know. So this guy's basically like, look, we're not very smart around here, but we don't trust this. And believe me, we did everything we could to prove this was fake and we couldn't do it.
We saw what we saw.
A published paper called the Gazette Medicale also said, "The non-appearance of the phenomena at such or such a given moment proves nothing in itself. It is but a negative fact, and as such cannot disprove the positive fact of their appearance at another moment, if that be otherwise satisfactorily attested." So basically, just because it didn't happen when you did it doesn't mean it didn't happen when we did it.
Right. Okay, well, good. There's at least some people backing her.
Lots of people. A lot of people.
I was feeling real bad.
Another thing that seemed to be in favor of Angelique, as opposed to the committee, was that on March 10th, the day after the committee's final report, Angelique was at Dr. Tanchu's house when her apron brushed the edge of his table. Her hands were behind her back and her feet were 15 inches away from this table. The table rose entirely off the ground. Another doctor witnessed this and declared that during the whole time, he never saw the slightest movement of either her hands or feet, and he regarded deception under the circumstances to be utterly impossible. So he watched her apron brush up against it, and there's no way. Her hands and feet didn't move.
Yeah, she was standing still.
This happened a couple more times in March in front of various other doctors as witnesses, but by the end of March, her powers were all but gone. Angelique would go on doing shows through April 10th at her father's behest.
Shocker.
Most believing he attempted to fake the powers at this point. But after just a few days, they announced that her powers were gone and they never reappeared again in her lifetime.
Well, good.
Angelique went back to her normal life as a normal child, free from shaking chairs and flying objects.
Good. At least it wasn't something she had to deal with her whole life. Yikes.
So can you imagine, though, this girl, like, all of a sudden she can't touch anything. Things just fly across the room. Her house becomes this dangerous tornado of burning wood and scissors.
Oh, I'd be so mad. The peas just, there was a rage inside of me.
Right? And all these doctors are studying her and she's having to perform shows.
Yeah.
And then she goes to see this committee and they're like, yeah, this girl's faking. There's nothing special about her. And all these people came out and, you know, stood up for her. And they're like, we saw this happen.
Yeah, that I'm surprised about.
So, and then they just disappeared one day. Yeah. And she just went back to normal, went back to living her life like it never happened.
Maybe she got a really bad buildup of electricity.
I don't remember. I said the storms were happening up until it started. But still, like, can somebody up electricity? Like,
I don't know.
I really liked doing this story because even I couldn't come out and say this is clearly fake I usually do.
I noticed the whole story, there was nothing.
I didn't have anything to pick apart. Like, yes, this committee said she was faking and they couldn't recreate these experiments, but they had already acknowledged at this point that her powers were diminishing.
Yeah.
And there were thousands and thousands of witnesses that saw this happen.
Yeah. And then the doctors themselves that did study her, like, why would all of them have faked that?
Right. Like, this would have been a massive, massive undertaking for everyone to pretend they really saw this. Right.
Exactly.
Or a very, very good stage show.
That's a weird one. I like this one.
Now, according to another podcast I heard that did this story, there were a couple of women who actually lived in Georgia in the U.S., you know, several years, 50 years or so, whatever, after Angelique lived, that claimed to be electric. They had an electric show. And they would basically do all of these same things. They'd make blocks rise. They'd make chairs move. But they later came out after, you know, a very successful career of this show, saying, you know, it was all stage tricks. But they never revealed how they did it. But I wonder if, did they copy Angelique and do the same tricks that she did? Or did they look at Angelique's story and say, let's make it look like we can do that?
That's what I wondered.
Because it did happen after them. I can't remember exactly how much. I should have totally researched that, but I didn't.
This wasn't about them.
So it was a very interesting one. I feel like because they waited so long to monetize this, because they gave up when her powers disappeared. Like, you'd think if they were faking it, they could fake it forever.
Right.
Why would they
just be like, a month? 2 months?
Yeah, it lasted about 3 months total.
Did it? Okay. Yeah, like, that, it would have gone on a lot longer if they were trying to, like, fake it.
Yeah, her powers appeared in January and they were gone by March.
Okay.
So if they could successfully do it and he was making money and people were loving it, why would they stop?
Right.
Unless especially, they didn't have a choice to stop.
I don't know. They would have monetized it a long time before that, too.
You would think so.
Like, there were a lot of people that saw her before Dad was like, oh, we can make money off this.
Right? Why would you let 2,000 people watch her for free
before
you started charging for it? Like, I have a hard time disproving this one.
I mean, it's not out of the realm of possibility, though, either.
Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, we are conductors.
And obviously it fixed it when she stood on glass.
Yeah.
It had something to do with her feet touching the ground. I don't know. This one was a crazy case, and I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, I like this one. And
this poor girl was, you know, famous for 3 months and then just had to go back to living the rest of her life in France, weaving gloves.
Yeah, that sounds nice right now. So before I go into the actual story, just a little background. This happens in Erdington, Birmingham, England. Erdington is a suburb of Birmingham, England that dates back to the 9th century. So there's plenty of history there. And the creepiest part of Erdington is the strange story of these two women who died, whose details were eerily similar.
I've never heard of this. I'm pretty excited to hear this story.
I've heard a snippet of it, but I've never gone through all the details. So this was really wild.
It reminds me of that story where the guy was killed by the cab driver, and then like a year later, his brother was killed by the same cab driver in the same spot on the same day.
It's kind of like that. Yeah. It really is. Okay. So let's start at the beginning with Mary Ashford. Early in the morning of May 27th, 1817, a worker named George Jackson came across a pile of clothes, a hat, and some shoes by like a water-filled pit in this park.
Okay.
Now, this area will be later known as Pipe Hayes Park. This will be important later. Just remember that.
Pipe Hayes Park. Got it.
He, of course, alerted local authorities, and they dragged the pit to see what they could find, because obviously there's stuff in there.
Maybe there's something else down there.
Maybe there's something in there. Unfortunately, they did find something, and that was the body of 20-year-old Mary Ashford. She had bruising on her body, and it was presumed that she had even been raped before she had died.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So here's what the police had found out. Mary, who had had a handful of suitors, which I'm only adding in to say that it could have been anyone. Not that she was loose or whatever you want to say. Like, that wasn't the issue.
It's just that there was a lot of suspects.
Yeah, there could have been a lot of suspects in here. And Mary walked from Langley Heath to Birmingham on her way to work on May 26th, which was the day before she died. This was on a holiday called Whit Monday. I'd never heard of this, so I don't know a lot about it.
I've also never heard of that.
It's also known as a Monday of the Holy Spirit, and it's the holiday celebrated after Pentecost.
Okay.
Yeah. So apparently they do. I don't know how they celebrated it or anything, but it looks like it's just something you go out and it's like a bank holiday where you have the day off and you can go celebrate, party. And they had a dance.
Like a little hoedown?
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, I guess in the 1800s it wasn't a hoedown.
Probably not. It was a party of sorts. At first, she stopped at home where her friend Hannah Cox lived and dropped off some clothes and stuff that she was planning on wearing that night at the party. And at 6 p.m. that night, Mary returned to Hannah's room from work, and she changed for the party, and Mary and Hannah went on. They then left to attend that dance at Tyburn House, which is in there somewhere.
It's a place.
It's a place. By all accounts, the girls had a good time. They spent a lot of their time with two men, Benjamin Carter and Abraham Thornton. At the end of the night, the four of them left. It was about midnight. They walked along Chester Road, which was a main road in Erdington.
Okay.
From there, Hannah went back home. Benjamin left to go back to the dance. Like, he had dropped Hannah off. He went back to the dance. And Mary and Abraham actually continued towards Mary's grandfather's house.
Abraham's looking a little suspicious here then.
Oh, okay. At around 4 a.m., Mary returned to Hannah's home to change back into her work clothes.
Oh.
So, she's still alive.
She's still alive and awake. Mm-hmm. Guess she's not sleeping that night. It's party night.
Hannah said that Mary seemed calm. She seemed in a pretty good mood. And when Hannah asked about what happened after the dance, Mary said that she had spent time with Abraham before he left.
Spent time with him?
Well,
Maybe we'll talk about hanky panky. Okay.
After this, witnesses did claim to have seen Mary walk the road alone, like leaving Hannah's house, I guess probably to go back to work, let's be honest.
Without sleeping. Ugh, that's the part that's getting me. Yeah. To be 20 years old again, I guess.
They saw her a short time after 4 a.m. You know, she went back to change into work clothes and then left. But it was only a few hours later that Mary would be found dead. So between that time frame of a little after 4 a.m. to when George found her, what, 8 a.m.?
Mm-hmm.
She was dead. So it was a little bit before that, because 8 a.m. was when Abraham Thornton was accused of her death and was arrested.
Well, I mean, it kind of, I see how they got there.
Yeah. No, that was the last person who saw her.
He clearly did it. Right. I mean, that's all the evidence they need, I guess.
He reportedly told police, "I cannot believe she's murdered. Why? I was just with her until 4 o'clock this morning." When questioned, Abraham told detectives that he and Mary had had sex that night in the fields. And then afterwards, they had talked and watched the night sky until around 3 a.m. before Abraham walked her part of the way back to Hannah's house, and that she finished walking to Hannah's house on her own.
Okay.
He said he had waited for her outside, then left when she didn't come back for some time. But my question is, how was he waiting on her there if he'd only walked her part of the way home?
That's what I was just thinking. Like, did he wait for her down the road? Did he not want to be seen with her? Mm. I mean, I guess it was pretty scandalous. So,
Yeah. Okay. Maybe.
Maybe like, you leave first and I'll come after. Like, you know.
Maybe. Yeah. Okay. Maybe. I'll give you that. But this was the last time Abraham allegedly saw Mary alive.
But like, people saw her walking towards work, right?
Like, she had left the house. Some witnesses said they saw her. So if he was, maybe he didn't stand there long enough. Maybe he's like, okay, maybe she's not coming back out.
Or maybe she didn't need to go that way for work. And she, but maybe. Like, she would know he was waiting for her though, right? I mean, surely he'd be like, I'll be right here. See you when you get back. Or was he just creepily waiting there? Well, like,
or was he, see, I try to look at it both ways. Maybe it was like a romantic thing. Oh, I'll just wait on her. I don't know. The police weren't buying it, and they found a nail in his boot that was said to have matched the shoe footprints left at the scene.
Complete with a nail print?
That's how I'm reading it.
I mean, that's pretty hard to dispute, I guess.
Right? So, of course, he's arrested. He's accused of her murder, and he's set to go to trial.
I wonder how they determined that she was raped in the 1800s. I mean, he admitted to having sex with her. Like, surely they didn't do all the forensic, like, is there bruising and scrapes? Well, maybe they did. I don't know.
Because it's not like she was in that water for a long time.
Yeah.
So I'm sure they would be able to find some scrapes and bruises and stuff.
Hmm.
I don't know. I don't know a lot about forensics in the 1800s.
I don't either.
Maybe that's something I should explore. So Abraham Thornton's trial began on August 8th. And of course, everyone in town already thought, like, the slam dunk trial, like, he did it. He's going to jail. Hang him. I don't know what they did back then. I guess they hung people.
I mean, I think so. That sounds right.
But I mean, even the public was like fully convinced that he had killed Mary.
I mean, I'm kind of convinced at this point, too. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds completely plausible. However, three witnesses came forward and confirmed Abraham's alibi. That, along with the fact that there was no real hard evidence to prove his guilt, just that nail in his foot shoe footprint. In his foot shoe print. Now look. The jury found Abraham Thornton not guilty in just 6 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah.
6 minutes.
Right. However, Mary's brother, William Ashford, was not about to accept this as the verdict, and he appealed for a second trial.
I mean, I can see that. You want justice for your sister, right? And you feel like this guy did it, and he's getting away with it. Right. So. Well,
the whole town thought it.
Yeah.
I'm sure he really thought it. So, on Abraham's second trial, there were some antiquated laws that were still in effect at that time that allowed someone to request trial by battle.
Oh my gosh. Are they about to duke it out? Fisticuffs?
Fisticuffs. Yes. Now, I'm sure we all know what this is, but essentially this is where two would fight. And in this case, it's like a fight to the death, usually, and whoever the winner is would be declared right. Like, again, in this case,
can't be right if you're dead.
Right? If Abraham won, he was free. If William won, he was guilty.
That's crazy.
Well, it's so wild.
I'm stronger than you, therefore my version of events is correct. Like, what?
And it the fact, okay, the judge, Lord Ellenborough, agreed to it. He's like, yeah, fine. Okay.
Okay, you guys duke it out, whatever.
Yeah, and that's my thought. He probably just wanted to see how this played out. Like, okay. Abraham apparently made this big dramatization about trial by battle. He threw his leather glove up over his head and he began the challenge and said, I am not guilty and I will defend myself with my body.
I'm sorry. It's very noble.
You're right. Now, the terms again that were if Abraham won, he would be acquitted. If he lost, he was going to be hanged.
That's good motivation to fight with everything you right. got, I guess.
Well, it never happened because William was not about to get into this. Like, he thought it was stupid. He didn't even bother responding to it. Like, it was just whatever. It's like, I'm not doing that.
So Abraham is the one who wanted the trial by battle?
Yeah.
I thought it was the brother.
No. Abraham's it was Abraham.
Like, fight me? He really just said, fight me.
Yeah. Like, he's like, I didn't dare fight me about it. But yeah, William's just like, this is stupid. I'm not doing this. And because of this, the case was discharged and Abraham was a free man.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, no one ever found out who the true killer was. Like, was it Abraham? I don't know. They never found anybody else. And to this day, like, it's still, like, I guess, a cold case.
I'm pretty suspicious of Abraham, but I don't know. It's hard to know.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we don't have a lot to go on. Forensics wasn't a thing.
I mean, they have those shoe prints, but I mean, I guess nails in your shoe might have been pretty common.
I don't know. Well, I mean, I know back then, like, their shoes were probably nailed, like, the soles of the shoes were probably nailed to the rest of the shoe. Like, I know, but I don't know. Maybe it was just a pattern of the nails in the shoe.
I assumed he had, like, stepped on a nail and it was stuck in the bottom of his shoe and you could just see
that.
It there.
Yeah, I thought that originally, and I was like, probably not, because shoes weren't that great back then.
A tiny nail, maybe.
Maybe.
I don't know.
We're really going on about this nail here.
It seems like an important piece of evidence.
Well, it's the only evidence. So Abraham's free. And although free, he had a really hard time, like, even regaining his reputation in town.
I mean, I guess so.
Everybody thought he killed her. The public still fully believed he killed Mary, and nobody wanted anything to do with him after the trial. And apparently it had gotten so bad that Abraham, like, had to finally just leave his home and make his way to the U.S. His first attempts to leave were stopped when one of the passengers recognized him on a boat and refused to sail with him.
Oh.
Like, it was bad. He finally made it there. He settled in New York. He married. He prospered. And he died. He just lived the rest of his life.
I mean, I guess he didn't kill anybody else if he did kill her. So there's that, I mean, that we know of.
Yeah. And to just give you a little bit of a history on how women were treated in the 1800s, Mary, who was just a girl and who was brutally murdered, has a headstone that reads, quote, as a warning to female virtue and a humble monument to female chastity, this stone marks the grave of Mary Ashford, who on the 20th year of her age, having incautiously repaired to a scene of amusement without proper protection, was brutally murdered on 27th May, 1817.
They victim blamed on her headstone.
On her headstone.
Like,
for all of eternity.
She had sex and she wasn't careful and now she got murdered. Don't do that, kids.
It makes me think of Mean Girls. Don't have sex or you'll die.
Right? Like, that's what they're saying.
That's sick. That's so sick.
Oh, somebody needs to take that headstone down and, like, give her a better one.
Hopefully they did. I don't know. I need to look at that, but I doubt it. So, fast forward 157 years later. On May 27th, 1974, 20-year-old Barbara Forrest was found murdered in a ditch near Chester Road in Erdington near Pop Hayes Park, which was just 500 yards from her own home. Barbara worked as a nurse at Pop Children's Home, which was also nearby. Her body showed signs of rape and strangulation, much like Mary's was found. And just like Mary, Barbara had gone missing on Whit Monday as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, was Mary strangled? Did we know that, or just that she was dead?
Just that she was dead and possibly raped, but there were, if I remember right, there were ideas that she was strangled.
Okay.
But it wasn't, I kept getting, was she not? Like, so I didn't want to add it just yet.
Okay.
So reports state that Barbara had been out with her boyfriend, Simon Belcher, the evening of her death.
Okay.
Much like Mary. Well, I don't know if it was her boyfriend, but.
I mean, close enough.
They knew each other well.
They were familiar.
They had been out dancing at several bars And then Simon walked her to the bus at 1 a.m., which was the last time he saw her. Unfortunately, there was no one who had seen her after that time. Even passengers on the bus that she was supposed to take didn't even remember seeing her, and detectives weren't even sure she got on the bus at all.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he says she got on the bus, but like no one else can confirm that story.
At this point.
Okay.
Yeah. A witness finally did come forward and say that they did see a blue car parked near where Barbara's body had been found around the time that she would have been killed.
Okay.
And if Simon had walked her to the bus, I'm assuming he probably didn't have that blue car.
I mean, why not drive her home?
Right.
If he did.
Yeah. So over 100 detectives went out looking for the killer.
Wow.
Yeah. Like apparently this was a big deal. And they finally zeroed in on a man who shared the last name of Thornton.
Oh.
Yeah. Michael Ian Thornton actually lived on Chester Road and had been a coworker with Barbara.
What?
Yep. Thornton had an alibi. However, police found out that it was a false alibi from his mother and had also found bloodstains on his pants, which they couldn't prove with DNA. They're about a decade away from that. But it's still odd that he has it.
Yeah.
So they apprehend and charge Michael for the killing. Just like before, Thornton was put on trial. And just like before, there was not enough evidence to find him guilty, and Thornton walked free.
Did he also ask for some fisticuff trial? Man,
that would have been amazing.
It would have been.
And just like before, Barbara's sister refused to accept this verdict and demanded the case be reopened and DNA reviewed in 2012.
Okay. That's way more recent than I anticipated.
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately, from what I could find, I did search around. Police have not been able to do any forensic testing.
I mean, it's from 1974, yeah. So that's a long time to keep evidence and have it in good shape. And
yeah. Well, there were mentions when I did look around that the samples may have been lost or corrupted. I mean, it was 38 years, I'm sorry. And, you know, just testing couldn't be done on it.
Right.
So there's no way to prove it. And at this point, I'm sure that Thornton guy's up in age and...
Yeah.
If he's even alive, I didn't even think to check. But, so that's still technically an open case, too. Something else that's eerily strange and similar about these two cases, though, both Mary and Barbara had a sense of dread before their deaths.
Hmm.
Mary reportedly told Hannah's mother that she had, quote, bad feelings about the week to come. And Barbara had just told a coworker 10 days before her death that, quote, this is going to be my unlucky month. I just know it. Don't ask me why.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. And just for a little spook. Apparently, Popeyes Park is said to be a place where medieval lovers would often carry out suicide pacts and is said to be haunted by ghosts of all of those forlorn people, which is really weird considering the fact that both Mary and Barbara were on dates.
Right. And, with, you know, lovers, apparently.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about Barbara.
Yeah, that one, I don't know. But, yeah, pretty similar cases.
In the same spot.
Mm-hmm. And they're both cold cases. Both the men Thorntons were acquitted.
Both the women were the same age.
Yeah.
Like, that's the same
road. The same holiday, same road. Like, it's so weird.
That is a strange one.
Thanks for listening.
Like us on Facebook at True Crimes and Weird Times Podcast.
Follow us on Instagram at True Crimes Weird Times.
Email us your stories at truecrimesweirdtimes@gmail.com.
And if you enjoyed the show, make sure to subscribe and leave a review.
Bye.